This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming today, we'll hear from veteran Louisiana political consultant Roy Fletcher on President Trump's first State of the Union address. It's tonight. And Roy Fletcher will also opine about the continuing investigation into possible Russian involvement in the 2016 election. Concordia Sentinel editor Stanley Nelson of Faraday on his quest to solve the mystery of several 1960s racially motivated murders in Louisiana and in Mississippi. And East Baton Rouge Parish Metro Councilman Matt Watson is slated to be with us to discuss the council's action to thwart human trafficking, a problem that is permeating much of the country and a significant issue in Baton Rouge. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your toll-free number in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Later in the hour, we'll hear from the veteran political consultant Roy Fletcher. President Trump is going to give his first State of the Union address tonight, and we'll also hear, if things go according to plan, from East Baton Rouge Parish Councilman Matt Watson about the council's action to thwart human trafficking in Baton Rouge. We start with Stanley Nelson. He is an editor with the Concordia Sentinel and Faraday. He's been with us a few times, writes about the region's turbulent history, and even Stanley has been astonished by his own discoveries over the last decade or so about the corrupt and violent behavior of the KKK in the 1960s in Louisiana and Mississippi. And there is one case in particular that has some new wrinkles. And Stanley, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
Well, good to talk with you. And we have visited many times through the years, and of course, on our renewal of this show last year, one of our first guests first day was Greg Iles, the fabulous novelist, and he credits much of his recent work to your work.
Yeah, well, Greg is very nice about doing that, and he did spend a little time with me and followed some of the cases with me, but his trilogy on those Klan cases, the Natchez Burning Trilogy, is ultimately his story, and it's just unbelievable. If I could write like Greg Iles, I would be doing exactly what he does. He's something.
Well, before we get to your work, which continues, how did you get involved in this?
Well, back in 2007, I've always had an interest in understanding the Klan and had written a story or two through the years. But in 2007, the FBI reopened some old cases from the 1960s, and there was a man from Faraday named Frank Morris who owned a shoe shop who had been murdered in December of 1964. And so I began to write about that story, not thinking it would amount to much, until I heard from his granddaughter, and she began to tell me what it was like to live through the years of her life. She was 12 when he died, and she began to talk about how much she wanted to know who killed her grandfather, and really ultimately how much she wanted to know why, what he possibly could have done for someone to want to burn his shoe shop down while he was still inside and ultimately cost him his life. And mm-hmm. So that's sort of how it began, and I began to learn about more cases and began to talk to more families of victims, and it just grew, and it continues to grow.
Well, the Frank Morris death was in December of 64, if I remember correctly. So we're
That's
talking
right.
53 years and a month since Frank Morris literally gave his life. And I'm sure that if he were alive, he would be somewhat content that his life was not in vain, that his death certainly was the catalyst for your work, which has caused many other cases to be reopened. And some people have been brought to justice, and even in cases like in Frank Morris's, where the person was not brought to justice, we know a lot more now than we did before.
We certainly do, and I always tell people, they say sometimes, Why do you spend all your time fooling around with something that happened so long ago? And the thing that struck me when I began to do this and continues to stay with me is, if it was your father, your grandfather, your brother, sister, whoever, that was murdered and that case remained unsolved, believe me, you would do everything you could do to find out what happened. And these families have lived with this for years, and not only is it beneficial for them for these cases to be looked at again, it's also beneficial for the communities, for them to know their history and to understand why maybe the racial situation is the way it is in some communities today. So, but you cannot live in any community and let any murder go unsolved. That's just, you just can't do it.
And your reporting has been at some risk to you personally.
I have. You know, you work for a newspaper. If you don't get, cursed out fairly often, you figure, well, I'm not doing my job very well. Huh. But yeah, there were some threats, but you don't dwell on that. You just move move ahead. And there's a big difference in working these cases now. Doing this back in the 1960s, while all this was going on, would have been a whole different story.
877-217-5757 is your number, and talk at talklouisiana.org. Stanley Nelson is our guest. He is a Louisianian, lives near the Mississippi line, has reported for many years for the Concordia Sentinel, where he is the editor, and this is a area that's rich in all kinds of culture, be it music or being the home of the birth home of many luminaries, including Howard K. Smith and, of course, Jimmy Lee Swaggart, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Mickey Gilley. And it also has, unfortunately, this sinister history. And a listener in Woodville, who's listening all the way up in Woodville, not far from where you are, asks about the involvement of the Silver Dollar Group. Was this the group that was the main culprit in all these terrible killings that were going on?
Well, what we found out once we started doing this is that we were able to, these different murders seem to be connected by certain Klansmen. And ultimately what we learned is there were a group of Klansmen who belonged to the traditional Klans, but secretly in the spring of 1964 joined together to form the Silver Dollar Group. Each member carried a silver dollar minted in the year of their birth, and their purpose was to stop integration at all costs with violence or whatever it took. And so we, I sort of refer to them, because I can't think of a better way to put it. They would, I guess if you had a football team in Louisiana, you had an all-state team, the best players you had, these would have been the worst, most despicable Klansmen they were, and they were violent prone. And so the Silver Dollar Group was, I believe, very possibly involved in the murder of Clifton Walker near Woodville, Mississippi, and also in 1964.
Clifton Walker.
Yes.
That's one I don't know much about.
Well, in February of 64, he was in a carpool with black man and a couple of white men, and he was driving. They met up at Nettles truck stop outside Woodville, got into the respected cars after they had finished a night of work. It was around 11 or 12 o'clock. Clifton Walker got into his car, turned on to Poorhouse Road en route to his house, and didn't get far when he was ambushed on the road by men firing from both sides of his car, and he was found dead. And his case was one of many in which no one was ever arrested and no justice ever served.
Now, you have been working cases continuously, 11 years now, and there is one in particular that has some potential new wrinkles. Tell us about this one.
Well, we've become working with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and we're taking our first look, but it's a case that's been looked at many times, but it was the murder of a black deputy in Washington Parish named O'Neill Moore. And the murder happened in 65, but in 1964, O'Neill Moore and Creed Rogers, both in their 30s, were the first black deputies hired by the Washington Parish Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Dorman Crow. They had worked about a year when, in June of 65, they were driving into the town of Ornado, and which is where O'Neill Moore lived. And just a quarter mile away, his wife was preparing a catfish supper for the two men when they got off of work. But as they drove into Varnado and crossed the railroad tracks, they had noticed a black pickup had been following them. And at that point, as they crossed the tracks, the pickup began to pass. And as it did, men inside that truck began to open fire with a shot, at least one shotgun, and with rifles. O'Neill Moore was driving, and the car crashed into a tree, and O'Neill Moore was killed, but his partner, Creed Rogers, was able to call in to the sheriff's office and describe that truck.
Well, do you think that we're going to find exactly what happened? I know that there was a man accused of this crime.
There was. When Creed Rogers was in the passenger car, he radioed in to the sheriff's office, and he said, "I see a black truck." It was a black truck with a white grill and a Confederate flag emblem to the right of the center of the bumper. And they put out an APB, and within an hour, that truck was pulled over in Tylertown, Mississippi, and the owner of that truck was a man named Ernest Ray McElveen.
We'll return in just a moment. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. And Stanley Nelson is with us for a bit longer, the editor of the Concordia Sentinel in Faraday. And Stanley's been on the trail of several murderous acts in Mississippi and Louisiana in the 1960s. People being killed because of their involvement in the civil rights movement, and in some cases just killed because they were African American. And one of the latest cases that Stanley is immersed in is this killing of O'Neill Moore. You say that a fellow named Ray McElveen was accused of the crime, Stanley, but ultimately was let go. What happened?
He was arrested in Tylertown, Mississippi, taken to Franklinton, which is the parish seat of Washington Parish, hired an attorney, Ossie Brown, the former...
O.C. Brown, yeah.
O.C. Brown, the former D.A. And 9 or 10 days he was in jail, and he was released because no evidence was presented to present him to continue to hold him. The FBI intensively investigated this case on and off for 50 years and came up with a list of potential of 24 suspects. They knew McElveen was involved, but the thing about this particular attack on those two black deputies, which we believe was probably the first and perhaps the only during the 60s case in which the Klan targeted black law enforcement officers. And so once... McElveen was released from jail. The Bureau was unable to find any evidence enough to prosecute, and they could never find enough evidence to arrest anyone else. And it was a military-style attack, and it was apparently well-planned. And it was fortunate that Creed Rogers survived so that he at least could identify that truck and eventually led to the rest of McElveen.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Stanley Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Nelson. Do you believe that Trump's equivocating on the responsibility for the Charlottesville troubles encourages the Klan, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists in general?
I don't know. I don't know that I can answer that question. I always tell my thoughts on such things as Charlottesville. When you can, You know, the difference in now in the 60s is that the Klan was shrouded in secrecy, and many times you didn't know who all was in the Klan or who wasn't. But when people are walk around in the streets with their faces sitting there, and you can identify every one of those white supremacists that was at that rally, that's a good thing for the FBI and for law enforcement. At least they know who these people are, and they can keep up with them. What I worry about is the people who are working underground right now, white supremacists, who we do not know about. And I also try to stay clear of politics, because I'm going into white communities trying to find out and talk to families of Klansmen. I'm trying to work in the black communities, and I have to be objective and unbiased in my reporting. And so I try not to get myself involved in politics.
Chuck in Scott, Louisiana. Chuck, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Stanley Nelson.
Good morning. I'm wondering if Mr. Nelson is familiar with the novels of Greg Iles, who has written about similar incidents. Of course, they're in novel form, but his group of Klansmen, et cetera, they receive a gold $20 gold eagle when they're admitted into this terrorist group.
All right, I think you are somewhat familiar with Mr. Iles and Greg Iles. Yes, has said that Stanley is the motivator for his latest work.
Yes, and the double eagles was based on the Silver Dollar Group, an actual Klan group, and the Silver Dollar Group actually carried silver dollars that were minted in the years of their births, and that's where Greg Iles created the double eagles.
It is hard to believe that these people could live seemingly normal lives, have families, be loving parents, and yet at the same time be capable of going out and killing somebody just for the fun of it, basically, because they were African-American.
Well, it's amazing what human beings are capable of doing. And many of these men that were involved in these murders were really evil men, and who believed that they had to stop integration at all costs, and who literally just despised and hated black people. And there's no understanding that other than just to simply realize that some people just hate, and you can spend your lifetime trying to figure it out, but that's just the way they are, and mm-hmm. They're dangerous when they get that way. Very dangerous.
And you, as a good reporter, are trying to stay above the fray when it comes to politics, but it is amazing, Stanley, that so much of our politics today is affected by the issue of race.
It absolutely is, and it's because we seem to have an inability to talk, and it's important to be able, in doing the work that I try to do and others do, is to be able to go into someone's home and to be able to sit down and talk to them. And to be able to talk to them, it's difficult to begin the conversation when you are on one side of the political spectrum. You need to be able to put politics aside and see the humanity that is in all of us, because once we can do that, then we can begin to understand why doing everything we can to figure out who killed O'Neill Moore and tried to kill Creed Rogers is ultimately important. And even if the suspects are gone, somebody today is still alive who heard somebody make a comment, who maybe a widow, maybe somebody overheard a phone conversation, even if it doesn't result in an arrest because a suspect is dead. We can still write more about that history and have a better understanding. And I always feel that once you get all the evidence, you look at all the suspects, we can report actually how a murder occurred and who was involved. And that's what we've done in the Silver Dollar cases, and I hope that's what we can do with the O'Neill Moore case.
And lastly, you have credited some work from some LSU students and Jay Shalady from the Manship School in helping your cause.
Absolutely, and Jay has recently retired, and Chris Drew is now continuing the cause, but they have a cold case unit. and of students, and they go to Washington usually a couple times a year, retrieve FBI documents that they have received through the Freedom of Information Act, and they go out and investigate cases. I've actually had written stories with some of the students, and they are great investigators, very dedicated, and I have benefited greatly by their work.
Stanley, thanks for joining us, and we'll be calling again soon. Appreciate your
time. Thanks, Jim.
And congratulations on your work.
Thank you.
The East Baton Rouge Metro Council last week passed a measure aimed at preventing human trafficking and prostitution at hotels in our community. And we're going to talk about this with Matt Watson, East Baton Rouge Metro Councilman. Hotels will now have to apply for permits and will have to undergo inspections performed by the city. And if officials find suspicious activity, the hotel could face fines, lose permits, or forced to close. And hotel guests will also be required to provide their name and address as well as a photo ID when they check in. So this is something that has been an issue in our community. And city leaders say the ordinance will take effect in 180 days. So we'll talk about it with Matt Watson, who's been at the forefront of this. And we'll also hear from Roy Fletcher, the veteran political consultant. Tonight is State of the Union night for President Donald John Trump. 1 year and 10 days into his presidency, his first State of the Union address. And remember, it was the first State of the Union address from Barack Obama that was followed by the infamous rebuttal from Bobby Jindal. We'll go back to the archives and hear Governor Jindal in 2009. Hard to believe it's been 8 years, but that's something Governor Jindal would probably likely like to forget, but we'll hear a bit of it. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us, 877-217-5757. Matt Watson is with us, and then we'll hear from Roy Fletcher. Sasha Kabashaw is producing, and if you can call here in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Last week, the Metro Council passed a measure in East Baton Rouge to address the issue of human trafficking. In Andrea Gallo's piece in The Advocate, it starts this way: East Baton Rouge leaders have created a system meant to curb human trafficking, prostitution, and other illegal activities, as they have flourished in some motels and hotels across the parish. The East Baton Rouge Metro Council passed an ordinance creating a system of permits, registrations, and fines that could force hotels or motels to become crime havens that have become crime havens to shutter after multiple penalties. So how is this going to be enacted as far as the practicality of it? I've got numerous stories about it, and the one I read earlier, you say, had some errors in it, Matt. What's going to happen in 180 days?
Well, Jim, thanks again for having me on your show. It's always a pleasure to be here. I want to first off say what we did, the district attorney's office reached out to me, and I believe reached out to most council members, about mimicking what the Jefferson Parish has already done in very similar way to curb problems that they had, hotels and motels in their area. It was brought to my attention. Immediately, I thought, well, one of many things that the government doesn't do well or doesn't know how to do is manage a hotel. So I reached out to the Hospitality Association, showed them the rules in Jefferson Parish, and said, how would this, for all practical purposes, work here? So they were absolutely instrumental in having this get to the finish line and get a unanimous vote last Wednesday night.
Unanimous vote. Rarely does the council vote unanimously.
And it's very seldom that there's applause after any vote at all, let alone a unanimous and applause. But this is going to do so much. And here's, for all practical purposes, here's what it is. A $100 permit that if any hotel has to get, and once they get that permit, and if they don't violate any laws, they never have to revisit getting a permit again. They never have to pay any additional permit fees or anything to that nature.
All right. Well,
go ahead.
There's some hot spots, aren't there?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I've got a list in front of me, and I'm going to tell you, when it was brought to my attention, I've got a list of all the hotels that are known in the parish. And of those hotels that have 120 calls for service, I mean, the worst hotel has 181 calls for service in the last data that the DA was able to get.
When you say calls for service,
calling either the sheriff if they're outside the city limits or the police.
Okay, and those hotels are?
I'm not going to give you the names of the hotels because these folks are going to get their act together and are going to curb this problem. But I'm going to tell you the location of these hotels, the six worst performers in the parish are all in District 11, my district. And people say, well, it seems like your area is a low crime area. How do you explain this? The proximity to I-10, I-12, and Airline Highway are these folks that are committing these crimes are coming from outside of our community and committing these crimes locally so long as they can get away with it, and then they move on those highways somewhere else.
All right. Well, Andrea, in her story, in The Advocate, mentions one on Boardwalk Drive.
Absolutely.
One on Gwynedell Drive.
Yep.
And one on Rieger Road.
Yep.
Okay.
Those are the worst ones. And she's privy to this exact list that I've got right here.
All right, and sex trafficking, for whatever reason, is apparently a significant problem in this area. And it's not just people in Baton Rouge. It's people coming here from other places, isn't it?
You're going to have people get on the Internet, on the back page, on Craigslist, or any other means of communicating this information where a John has a prostitute. And in cases like kidnapping people and transporting a hostage around the country and then advertising that person is available for paid sex. And then you've got people traveling on the road. So you've got, in a lot of cases, the John, mm-hmm. the person who's been kidnapped, and the people who are acting as a pimp in this situation are all people who don't live in our community.
Two Arkansas men were arrested last week after authorities said they trafficked a 16-year-old girl for sex in Baton Rouge.
They arrested them 4 days before Christmas last year.
Wow. Jeez. So it
500 feet from the
Chuck
E.
Cheese. What from the Chuck E. Cheese?
Yeah, on Boardwalk.
Okay. What are the fines?
The fines, actually, the Hotel Association came up with a graduated system of fines that increase as the size of your hotel increases. So I got to go back and look at those fines exactly because I left it up to them. We all seem to agree. The district attorney's office liked it rather than if you've got a hotel with 300 rooms and you're part of a nationwide chain, you can probably handle a larger fine. It would still need to get their attention to make them change the way they operate. But a small hotel that maybe has 4 to 8 rooms isn't going to be able to handle a $1,000 fine plus the shuttering of their business. You know, if when they go before the committee and determine that their negligence is what caused the crimes to be facilitated.
Okay, now I'm under the impression that hotel owners will have to submit applications with a fee to City Hall to include the name of the business, its address, emergency contact information, number of rental units, proof of liability insurance, and each time a hotel or motel changes owners, the owner will be required to apply for a new permit.
If they change ownership or change name, they'll have to get a new permit.
All right. Well, I think that is something that everybody can agree on is important, and you say it got unanimous support from the Metro Council.
Yeah. Let me throw one more thing in so everybody understands. I've seen some of the comments after some of these articles in The Advocate, some people who are all fired up but don't have the right information. When you get 3 or more calls for service for something having to do with drugs or prostitution at a hotel or motel in 90 days, you can lose your permit. That is unless the hotel proactively made those phone calls that led to the arrest. So right, this is community policing at its best.
And a listener says that most of the area hotels don't have any problems.
Most don't. Those who do are after the meeting on Wednesday, I saw folks from the Hospitality Association talking to the district attorney saying, can you please come and give us information and educate the folks who are going to be on the floor managing, the folks in housekeeping. Even so much, the DA said the people who do your exterminator work in the hotel can be key to getting information that leads to an arrest in human trafficking.
All right. And another listener, reflecting on your last appearance on the show, asks about the proposed tax to increase pay for police. Is that completely off the board now?
At the time that we did not have the votes to pass it that night. Our mayor came out and said that she was going to find money in the budget somehow. Her new hire, Murphy Paul, who's going to be a great police chief, reiterated in his introduction to the community that he was committed to finding more money to raise police pay, and I'm going to get out of their way and allow them to put their money where their mouth is and make good. I've heard from enough people they didn't want another property tax, and I agree completely. And if they can find the money, that's exactly where it should come from. And I look forward to what they find.
Thank you, Matt Watson. Always good to see you. And we're joined by Roy Fletcher, the veteran political consultant. And before we get Roy's comments on what may happen tonight with the 45th American president, remember the first State of the Union address from the 44th president, Barack Obama? It was followed by a rebuttal from one Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, who walked to the podium. And the moment he walked to the podium, Chris Matthews, I think you can even hear it on this tape, he was amazed because our governor looked a bit tentative as he was in the mansion as he strolled to the microphone. But here it is from 2009, hard to believe 8 years ago, Governor Bobby Jindal.
Good evening and happy Mardi Gras. I'm Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana. Tonight, we witnessed a great moment in the history of our republic. In the very chamber where Congress once voted to abolish slavery, our first African-American president stepped forward to address the state of our union. With his speech tonight, the president completed a redemptive journey that took our nation from Independence Hall to Gettysburg to the lunch counter, and now finally, the Oval Office. Regardless of party, all Americans are moved by the president's personal story. The son of an American mother and a Kenyan father who grew up to become leader of the free world. Like the president's father, my own parents came to this country from a distant land. When they arrived in Baton Rouge, my mother was already 4.5 months pregnant. I was what folks in the insurance industry...
All right, that's a pre-existing condition, Bobby Jindal said he was, and that's a speech that I'm sure he would like to take back, Roy Fletcher. He was riding high and seemed to be on his way to the White House himself. In fact, it was your former colleague, it was James Carville, who said it questions not if Bobby Jindal will become president, but when. Well, what happened on the way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
James missed that one. I said it was the biggest case of political malpractice I'd ever seen in my life. I actually wrote that and published it. I'll never forget that as long as I looked on that TV set and I saw this frail. I didn't know what the hell to make of. And to this day, I still can't believe it. It was the beginning and the end.
It was early in his term, and
It was the beginning and the end.
yeah, and of course, when he ran for president, people were still buzzing about that.
Yeah, it might be the most classic case of somebody taking him out on a speech that didn't matter, just taking themselves out, that I have ever seen in my life. I had to feel sorry mm-hmm. for
him. Well, the president's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, says that tonight will be must-see TV. Donald Trump knows his way around television cameras. Bobby Jindal obviously did not. The optics are sometimes more important than what is actually said.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's been efforts after efforts, particularly for the rebuttals, to meet the optics to some extent, to be able to put the person doing the rebuttal in some sort of setting that gives the impression of the authority of the president. That's impossible. That's just impossible. I mean, the Congress and all that is there and our familiarity with it is just overbearing.
We'll be back with Roy Fletcher after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. Roy Fletcher is our guest, the celebrated political consultant. He lives in Baton Rouge. He's worked all over the country, and he is one of the few consultants today who will occasionally work for a Democrat and or a Republican. He works mostly for Republicans now because the state has become wildly red in its politics and the candidates running for the offices at the highest levels in our state. Tonight, the rebuttal speech from after President Trump will come from a rising star in the Democratic Party. This is the same playbook the Democrats are using that the Republicans used 8 years ago with Bobby Jindal, but the Democrats have chosen Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy III, seen as a rising star. Of course, he'll bring the Kennedy magic to the microphone. He's the grandson of Bobby Kennedy, and also the great-nephew of both Edward Kennedy and President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And you know what? I bet he has watched the Bobby Jindal speech, Roy Fletcher, and they probably say, this is how not to do it.
I would suspect that they teach that. Exactly what you said, Jim. Okay, here's what you don't do. And then they go find some that have, you know, succeeded to some extent. It's not easy to succeed in a rebuttal, but it's very difficult if you catch yourself the way Jindal did. And just the aura and, as you said, the optics just did not work for Bobby Jindal that night. Not at all. And so I think Kennedy, I think it's an important point that the Democrats are making, and that is we're going to make Joe Kennedy a rising star in the Democratic Party tonight, or at least try. It's interesting.
Well, we'll see a lot of red hair from Joe Kennedy.
Yeah.
Who's a young
guy. And I'm sure it'll be flopping around a little bit.
Looking like his grandfather, Bobby. Now,
yes, sir.
Tonight we'll have, I'm sure, perfectly placed hair from the leader of the free world, Donald John Trump. His hair won't be moving at all, or as you say, flopping around. But he's shown when he sticks to a script and reads from a teleprompter, he can deliver a good speech. What do you think will happen tonight?
I think it'll be pretty substantive, and it'll be stylistically placed in a way that it'll draw distinctions that are pretty heavy. I think that his emphasis will be on immigration and the offer that he's made, which is essentially a pretty damn good offer, a moderate course. I think that his position with respect, he will spend a lot of time on trade, and it will be directed at China, and it will be tough. I think that's where he's headed, besides a regurgitation of what has happened to the country since the tax cut was passed and what it is meaning to people on a day. He will take on the notion of Nancy Pelosi that $1,000 and $2,000 bonuses are crumbs. That's getting ready to happen tonight. Finally, I think there will be one other thing on the immigration argument that he will do. He will repeat. He will quote Bill Clinton. He will quote Barack Obama. He will quote Chuck Schumer and what they said about immigration and illegal immigrants 8, 10, and 12 years ago.
Well, he'll probably mention the stock market, too, and we've talked before.
There's no question. That'll be part of the sort of that economic regurgitation that I'm talking about. But I think those three things will be the center point, the DACA, the China trade, and then the sort of the economic, what has happened to the economy will be the three themes of this thing.
All right,
and so it'll be a very economic-oriented speech. That's where his strength lies.
President Obama never mentioned the stock market, even though the Dow tripled on his watch, and the Dow has run up about 6,000 points under President Trump, but today it's down 280 points. I think
there's a little profit taken right now. I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Okay, well, there's another issue, as we know, that's
there's a big issue we hadn't mentioned.
And this is Newsweek's take on it. It says the Republican lawmaker who spearheaded a campaign to release a classified memo critical of the Justice Department and the FBI, quote, cherry-picked the contents in the document without ever reading all the source material. That's according to Adam Schiff, the congressman from California, who is taking aim at this report that apparently will be released, even though the Justice Department, headed by Jeff Sessions, says don't do it. Now,
Sessions advised, but Christopher Wray went and looked at it and made the decision about McCabe based upon what he saw.
You're saying that McCabe had to leave because of what's in this document?
Wray read what he read and said, you got to go. the underlying source material to this thing is not there, will be there, released once it is released. And there's a second part of the underlying source material. It is the OIG report by Michael Horowitz, which is coming in the next 48 hours.
Well, the Democrats wanted their report to be released, and the Republicans, who have the majority on the House Intelligence Committee, did not vote to release the Democratic report, only the Republican report. What do you make of that?
Well, here's what I make of it. Is where was the Democratic report? Nobody has seen one, on the one hand.
Well, why not release
it? But here's the bigger part of it. They voted to release the Democratic report to the House members in the same process and procedure as they did the Republican report, and there was no report to release.
Now, that's not what Congressman Schiff says. He says there is a report.
I don't care what he says. I've read too much about
what's
happened.
Well, I think he's closer to it than you are, Roy.
Maybe so. Maybe he is. But I can tell you, I mean, every report that I have read, there wasn't a report. And that's the problem. Give us a report and then release it. I don't care if they release 9 reports. Horowitz's report is going to be the determinant factor. It will lay the factual basis or probable cause.
Well, so far, not any of our congressmen other than Cedric Richmond, who's a Democrat, have criticized the president in any substantial way. Is this a surprise at all, or is this politics as usual?
No, I don't think it should be surprising that Cedric disagreed with the president, and I don't think it's surprising that the Republicans didn't. I mean, we got to admit one thing. It's politics. It is politics. But there are, what the problem is now is that there are factual basis out there that are coming behind this, and that Michael Horowitz report has taken 2.5 years. It is the mother of all reports. And it's the factual. It is why I believe that Jeff Sessions has been nothing but quiet through this whole process.
Do you think the president will reference the investigation tonight?
No, I don't. And I think that's a good question that I wanted to bring up. Is I don't think there are people said he should release them. I don't think that he will release any memo. I don't think any of that will go on tonight. I don't think that he'll reference it. I do think, however, tomorrow that memo, along with the factual basis, and very soon thereafter, the Horowitz report, will all get released.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Roy Fletcher.
Good morning, gentlemen. Wow, the hypocrisy and the corruption is neck high to try to wade through all that. Will they ever release the president's tax returns, and will ever get any day go by when Trump doesn't tell a lie? Thank you.
Well,
that's your friend Phil.
I think my response to that is that, hell, if we go hold Trump to not lying every day, we ought to hold every politician to not lying every day.
But he is different than others as far as the tax returns. He
said he'll push it. Yes, I'm not going to lie about that.
But is he in danger? Or will he fire Mueller? Or is this just going to
No. This is not about Mueller. This is about something else. And I think that Mueller's investigation continues on.
Jim in Denham Springs, we're going to slide you in. Jim, please be brief with Roy.
Absolutely. Roy, have you read the reports?
Horowitz's report?
Well, both reports. Have you read the underlying material?
Have I read what?
Read the underlying material?
No, nobody has read the underlying basis because there was no way that Nunes could release an underlying basis because he would have been violating the law. He released a memo.
Then exactly.
As a way
how can you complain
the underlying that, basis to it?
Then how can you complain
that
about
is, that? Is what, that was the cat trap that Nunes was in.
But how can you complain that the Democratic memo doesn't have any factual information?
Democrat.
You have.
All right, we got to roll, guys, but this is a subject that will continue, and we'll follow it. Thanks, Roy Fletcher. Thank you for listening. For Sasha Gabalshaw, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.